When I arrived in Jenin in mid-June, it was not under siege or under curfew, but everyone had a feeling it was going to be reoccupied shortly. And what I saw in Jenin just shook me to the core.
I first saw the underbelly of Israel when I was 18 years old, walking down a dusty path between shacks fashioned out of corrugated metal and government-issued shipping crates.
Good evening and welcome to Currents of Resistance, brought to you by the Atlanta Independent Media Center and WREK 91.1 FM. As always, we'd like to remind you that the opinions expressed here tonight are not necessarily those of WREK Atlanta. On tonight's show, we'll be focusing on the issue of the suffering of the Palestinian people under Israeli occupation and the efforts of international peace activists to ease that suffering. We'll be hearing audio from Voices for Justice, an event held May 4th at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation here in Atlanta. We'll also be hearing excerpts from an Atlanta IMC interview with Dan Fortson, who traveled to the occupied territories last summer. And in an IMC exclusive, we will be talking with Elizabeth Corey, the sister of slain peace activist Rachel Corey, killed by an Israeli bulldozer in Palestine last month. So, for our update section, we're going to be giving you a little bit of some news briefs that from Israel and Palestine that you may have missed on the corporate news. Take it away, Frank.
I'd like to start out with some recent history. Total deaths of Palestinians since September 2000 is 2,307. Total injuries, 22,646. This according to the Middle East Policy Council. 12,700 Palestinian homes have been demolished according to the UN. Israeli deaths in the same time period, 709, with 5,362 injured. This according to official Israeli military website. The Israeli violence recently has begun to have a frequent and fatal focus on journalists and peace activists. On April 19th, Nazi Darwaza, a Palestinian cameraman, was shot and killed by the Israeli military. 2 weeks later, on May 2nd, in Rafah, James Miller, a British journalist, was also shot dead, which would make that the eighth journalist killed by the Israeli government in the past 2 years. On March 16th, a 23-year-old Washingtonian activist with the International Solidarity Movement, Rachel Corey, was crushed to death by a bulldozer in the same Gaza town of Rafah. High death tolls and injuries among Palestinians have been commonplace since the beginning of the Second Intifada, which literally translates as awakening or shaking off. Since May 1st, 23 Palestinians, six of whom were women or children, were killed by Israeli occupying forces. Another 57 were injured. Two international activists were also critically injured. On April 5th in Jenin, 24-year-old ISM activist Brian Avery of New Mexico was shot in the face after he and another man stood unarmed with their hands up in front of Israeli soldiers. In Rafah, 5 days later, 21-year-old British peace activist Tom Herndl was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper and now lies in a Palestinian hospital in a coma with severe brain damage. The Israeli military raided the offices of the International Solidarity Movement last Friday, May 9th, confiscating and breaking equipment and computers, and incarcerating three women volunteers at the site, according to several indie media websites and the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Israel has barred any foreigners from hotspots in Gaza, forcing them to sign waivers of their lives if they wish to enter the occupied area. Meanwhile, 1,104 Israeli military personnel have formally announced their refusal to serve in an occupying force that exists, quote, in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people, end quote. All refusers face prison time for their actions.
All right. And now we're going to be bringing you some excerpts from the Voices for Justice event. The first person we're going to be hearing from is Ora Weiss. She's an activist and spoken word artist. She was born in Jerusalem, and she's the daughter of a rabbi. She was one of the organizers of this year's National Student Conference in Solidarity with Palestine, and we'll be hearing one of her spoken word pieces from May 4th.
Not 500 meters from Jerusalem's largest dump, at a time when my glorified perception of Israel did not include even the production of waste. This was a reservation, and my Bedouin friends, I came to understand, were living the uprooted, downtrodden lives of the Roma, the Lakota, the Aborigines, the Mayans. My parents never taught me to extend my concept of social justice to include Palestinians. My parents, my schools, my Hebrew school teachers, never encouraged me to hold Israel accountable for its acts of aggression. And now I am angry. I am angry because when I was younger, a budding revolutionary searching for heroes, I was presented with novels of Zionist underground fighters and Israeli secret service agents. But now I've found different stories. The stories of those virtually erased from our collective memory, and no thanks to my parents or my Hebrew school teachers, I claim them. These members of my non-Zionist past, these underground fighters I wish to be aligned with. I insist on recalling the Jewish trade unionists of Eastern Europe, the Jewish anarchists of Russia, the Arab Jewish writers and thinkers of social change, the Jewish women fighting fascism in the forests of France and Poland. I insist on breaking my chains. I insist on tearing down these apartheid walls. I insist on blowing up false dichotomies pitting Jew against Arab. I insist on honoring those Palestinians whose olive trees embody the very history of that land I feel this undeniable connection to. And yes, I do feel connected to the hills of Jerusalem, my birthplace, the shores of the Mediterranean, the closeness of the desert, the clamor of the shuk, but I feel no need to own it. In fact, I feel the need to preserve it. And what I see are Israeli attempts at being Western, destroying the aesthetics of ancient cities. I see bypass roads and superhighways tearing through precious small amounts of land. I see the waterline in the Sea of Galilee sinking lower and lower. I see the customs of Arab Jews and Palestinians suppressed and redressed for our pleasure. And I ain't saying that anyone else anywhere else is getting it any better, but please, stop idealizing our dear homeland. You talk about self-hatred? I'll tell you about self-hatred. I'll tell you a story of Arab Jews coerced into dropping their native tongues and changing their names upon entry into this new country, claiming to embrace all of our brothers and sisters, and then exploited in the fields, settled in border towns, brown buffer zones for Jews with white skin afraid to face the dangers of their own colonial process. Let me tell you a story of Israel's best friends, the Christian right, pouring money and power into settling the Holy Land, lobbying for Israel, so that finally when Armageddon comes, 2/3 of Jews will die and the other 1/3 convert. Let's talk about self-hatred. Let me tell you a story of us funding illegal settlements on stolen land, bulldozers crushing homes and lives, soldiers patrolling towns, imprisoning women and children in their room, men naked and blindfolded on the street, while students are shot in the head and pregnant women are dying at checkpoints, and us asking why can't there be peace? And us mourning 29 dead at a Seder in Netanya, 23 dead in Tel Aviv, every Palestinian killed before and after erased from memory, in fact not even permitted into our newspapers. But this is not an argument for the preservation of the moral integrity of the Jewish state by finally ending the occupation. Israel was never any more moral or noble than any other nation state or colonial project, including this one. I am not committed to a Jewish state at all costs. I am committed to direct democracy, people participating in the decisions that affect their lives. I'm committed to justice and peace and freedom. I'm committed to resisting all forms of oppression. I'm committed to reclaiming the diversity of my Jewish heritage, pre-narrowly prescribed Zionist identity, as I am committed to the preservation of Palestinian culture and independence, not to mention homes, villages, and schools. And I don't believe that a state which grants rights based on ethnic or religious identity lends itself to any of the above.
All right, you're listening to Currents of Resistance here on WREK Atlanta. That was Ora Weiss, activist with the International Solidarity Movement, speaking in Atlanta on May 4th. We're going to switch gears here a little bit. We're going to bring you excerpts from an extended interview we did some months ago with Dan Fortson. In June of July in 2002, environmental troubadour Fortson of Oregon traveled to occupied Palestine after he had been shocked by the reports a friend of his had sent back to him about what his friend had seen in occupied Palestine. He wanted to see firsthand what it was like over there, and he wanted to do what he put it as, use his freedom in defense of the freedoms of others. He wanted to go over there, see what was going on, and if possible, try to help the people there. What follows are excerpts from an interview we did on the anniversary of the one-year anniversary of the Jenin massacre in April of 2002. Frank has asked me to let you know that Dan is currently serving a federal prison sentence, a 3-month federal prison sentence, for his protests at the U.S. Army School of the Americas.
I arrived in Jenin in mid-June, it was not under siege or under curfew, but everyone had a feeling it was going to be reoccupied shortly. And what I saw in Jenin just shook me to the core. There's no other way to explain it. It is beyond war crime. It is a crime against humanity in Jenin. I was in Jenin for 9 days. I was losing about a pound a day because I was running on adrenaline and sleep deprivation. When the Israelis go house to house in occupied Jenin refugee camp, they will tell the media they are looking for terrorists. What they're really doing is smashing things up. The Israelis trash things, they knock everything over. They steal what they can steal. Now, I was in Jenin when they retook Jenin, and it was a full-scale military invasion. If there were any Palestinian defenders, they would be nothing more than a few men with Kalashnikov rifles against tanks, Apache helicopters, rockets, a full-scale world-class army on the offensive. When the Israelis went into Jenin in April of 2002, they demolished an area roughly about 1 acre. They demolished homes with people inside them. Some 55 people died during the invasion. It was, once again, beyond a war crime. It was a crime against humanity.
Dan worked with other international activists to try to protect ambulances and medical facilities in Palestine. He actually traveled to a lot of different cities, but we're focusing here tonight on his experiences in Jenin. We'll let him talk a little bit about those experiences with the ambulances.
This is another war crime. It really bothers me as a veteran because I've studied the Geneva Convention and I know the rules of warfare, and you do not shoot at an ambulance. What this man is pointing to here are bullet holes. It's a violation of Geneva Convention to shoot at an ambulance. More than 40 people have died during this second intifada because when a Palestinian ambulance comes up to a checkpoint, the Israelis will not let it through. And so if you have a pregnant woman or a person who needs to go to a hospital, more than 40 of them have died in the ambulances because they are not allowed to go through. There's no reason that the Israelis could not search the vehicle in 2 minutes and wave them through without incident. No reason other than politics. I rode shotgun with the Red Crescent, which is the Islamic equivalent of the Red Cross. I decided I would ride in the ambulances when I saw that they had been shot. I saw the bullet holes, and I said, I understand that there will be no more bullet holes in an ambulance while I'm here, at whatever risk. Myself and two Icelanders decided that was going to be something we were going to do. We spent 4 days riding in the ambulances. At that point, it was mostly routine calls. We had also made ourselves available to travel through a checkpoint if they needed us. We're leveraging our status as Westerners, that the Israeli armies had more respect for our lives than they do the Palestinians. But we were determined that that's what we were going to do. As it turned out, most of the calls were routine calls. We were delivering medicine. We were picking people up. In some cases, two of those days were under siege, and so ambulances were allowed to travel around when no one else was, delivering medicines and things like that. We did get stopped. We were interrogated, and I explained to people, to the soldiers, that I'm here as a human shield. They chose not to shoot at us for the time we were there.
The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, noted in September of 2002 that there had been a tenfold increase in the percentage of at-home deliveries of babies in the occupied territories as a result of closures limiting access to services. The result is that there's been a 58% increase in stillbirths in occupied Palestine. In addition to the ambulances, we talked to Dan about the overall effect of the closures and the curfews.
A curfew in occupied Palestine is when the Israeli army rolls into a town. These days it's not even announced. It's just known when the tanks roll in, you're under curfew. You are not allowed to go outside of your home. If you're at work when the curfew starts, you stay at work. If there are no beds there, that's not their problem. Obviously, it's impossible to conduct any reasonable amount of economic activity. It's impossible for children to go to school. A curfew means if you're a Palestinian and you're caught outside during curfew, you're shot on sight. You're presumed to be a terrorist and shot on sight. As far as what Palestinians have to say about it, they manage to find ways to get things done during curfew. You know, they stock up on supplies when they can so they can have something to eat during curfew. This curfew might last a week at a time, and then maybe it might be lifted for half a day and then shut back down. And then another week under curfew. These people are prisoners inside their own homes, inside their own country. You know, Palestinians do their best to try to get by, to try to make do. But clearly these curfews are a problem. They're strangling the economy of Palestine. They're interfering with children's ability to get an education.
Dan witnessed many terrible things during the weeks he was in Jenin as the Israeli tanks rolled back in. But we're just going to bring you one story he described, a story told to him by a Palestinian shoemaker.
This was a man who manufactured shoes, and his shop was next to his sort of in the basement of his home, so that he had the ability to be productive to some extent during the curfew. And the story that he told me was that he was running one of his machines. And he had quite an impressive industrial manufacturing setup in his basement there. And he was running one of his machines, and the soldiers heard it from outside his building and came in, asked him what was going on. I said, I'm manufacturing shoes. See, here's my shoes, and here's the laces, and here's the soles, and here's the raw the raw leather that I make the shoes from and such. I'm a shoemaker. And they decided that they would destroy the equipment. And I saw the equipment that they destroyed. Just smashed it up, wrecked the man's livelihood. Couldn't possibly be related to terrorism if he tried. These are specialized sewing machines, heavy-duty sewing machines, and things used in the manufacture of shoes. Couldn't possibly have anything to do with terrorism. Destroyed it just for the sake of destroying it.
Next, we're going to find out about the truth about Rachel Corrie's murder. We're going to talk to Elizabeth Corrie, Rachel Corrie's cousin. She's going to introduce herself and talk about her relationship with Rachel.
Yeah, I just wanted to introduce myself a little bit. Yes, I've lived in Atlanta for 10 years. I'm Rachel's first cousin, and even though she grew up in Washington State and I grew up in Ohio and Virginia, we saw each other every summer in Minnesota. Our grandmother had a cabin on a lake in Minnesota, and our extended family got together every summer. So I feel very close to her. I was very close to her, and I saw her grow up. She is our baby cousin. She's 8 years younger than I am. So for a lot of our lives, she was really too little for me to take seriously as my friend. She was more of the little cousin that was scampering behind us. But I did get to know her as she was starting to become a woman, and I do grieve that I won't get to know the woman she was going to become. When she left for Rafah, she emailed me. We were close enough that she did want me to be one of her emergency contacts. And so when she told me, asked me to be her emergency contact, that was actually the first I heard she was going to Rafah. So I was like, wow, okay. So I immediately signed on to the ISM distribution list and I began following what she was doing. And she frequently sent emails to her mother and to our family. So I followed pretty closely what she was doing from week to week.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you'd met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate.
As Beth continues, she attempts to demonstrate that the murder of her cousin was premeditated. She retells Rachel's story, the events of the day she was killed, March 17th.
I think most of us here basically know what happened to her, but just to summarize again, they had been there in front of the house of a man who's a physician, or perhaps a pharmacist, I think is more appropriate. They had been there for 2 hours already before she had been killed. And they had already been talking to him. And in fact, she had been learning Hebrew. There was a retired IDF general or officer who had been teaching her Hebrew things to say that would appeal to their consciences, like, what would your mother think of you? And she was learning to say things like that. I don't know if she had the opportunity to practice it that day. But she had already spoken to this soldier driving the bulldozer, and they had already been there for 2 hours. They had already been negotiating. She was wearing a bright orange fluorescent jacket and had a bullhorn, and there's really no way to believe that this could have been an accident. And to me, that's backed up by the fact that there was no sign of remorse or fear or, you know, afterwards. The Israeli soldiers did nothing to help her after she was hurt. And indeed, the next day when people came back to the memorial to plant flowers where she was killed and to memorialize her, they tried to break up the memorial service with tear gas and tanks. And to me, that doesn't sound like there was any accident or any feeling of there was a mistake. And this also comes from eyewitness reports, which are widely publicized and easy to access if you want to do that. And also, ironically, Rachel's father was in Vietnam, and he had a similar job of using bulldozers to move earth in Vietnam. And he knew that bulldozers, when pushing dirt, go very, very slowly. You can see someone and move out of the way or stop pretty easily. He also knew as a soldier that it was never appropriate to hurt a civilian in that context. And that was for the ethics of being a soldier.
As her foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest. Could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day?
We're listening to Elizabeth Corey, cousin of Rachel Corey, slain ISM activist. The following day, March 19th, at a memorial service that was being held for Ms. Corey, Israeli forces unleashed tear gas and concussion grenades and fired shots into the air. The same bulldozer that she was killed with was driven past the scene by Israelis. 10 people were hospitalized after that incident. You're listening to Currents of Resistance.
But what I wanted to say today is that I just wanted to say something about what Rachel has come to symbolize in our public discourse. Since her death, she's become basically a lightning rod for our public discussion and how people respond to me or to our family says everything about how they view the situation in Israel and Palestine, and it says everything about what they read or if they read anything at all. So anyone who's been following conversations on the internet or letters to the editor know that there's all kinds of different ways that people interpret the story of Rachel Corrie, and she was a martyr and a saint, or she was a traitor, she was a terrorist, and all kinds of other cruel things that you could use to say something mean about a woman. But there was a really wonderful article this week in the New York Observer, May 1st, that summarizes a lot of that quite well. And one of the things in there that was said that I think is very appropriate way to think about this is a woman named Hilda Silverman, who is a member in Boston of Jewish Women for Justice in Israel and Palestine, said, quote, "I didn't anticipate that anyone would be able to come up with a rationalization for what happened to Rachel, but she's been treated as rape victims have been treated." And I do think that's a way to think about it. And why? Well, human beings blame the victim because that way we can distance ourselves from the claim that that person's suffering has on us. If it's the victim's fault, then we don't have to take responsibility for what happened. If the victim is stupid or evil or made some sort of mistake, then because we're good and smart and know better, it would never happen to us. And so that's kind of how that psychology works. So this is, of course, not only what people are doing about Rachel, but this is the way the U.S. and Israel treats Palestine. We blame the victim for its own suffering. So the author of this article, Philip Weiss, says, you know, this because she's been such a lightning rod for this discussion, a lot has turned on her character and her motivation. And so he goes, very well then, let me tell you about her character. So I'm going to tell you about her character. Rachel Corrie was an intelligent, graceful, artistic, witty, playful, passionate young woman who understood herself to be a citizen of the world and who always stood on the side of the oppressed, the discarded, the disenfranchised, and the alienated. As a child, she adopted every injured and abandoned animal she came across, even those who had been so traumatized by other humans' treatment of them that they were untrusting of humans and therefore difficult to love. She had this one dog in particular that was insane and in fact even attacked her brother, but she would refuse to give it up because she was so devoted to this dog and no one else would take care of it. When she was 10 years old, in 1989, she delivered a speech that she wrote herself from the floor of the Washington State Legislature pleading for an end to world hunger by the year 2000. And she was pleading for those who are in developed countries to reach out to children starving in developing countries. And she said, we've got to understand that we are them and they are us. 10 years old. In seventh grade, she organized a walkout with her fellow students in support of the teacher's strike. And it was quite funny because she organized this without telling her parents. And her mother, Cindy, was out of town, and her father, Craig, was getting ready to go on a business trip, and he was leaving her in charge of her older brother and sister. And she finally confessed that she'd organized this walkout for the next day, and he wasn't going to be in town. And he was starting to freak out, like, no, you can't do this. You can't organize a walkout in the middle of school. And she's like, I have to. No, you don't. I have to. No, you don't. I have to. Why? Because I called the press. So she did organize a walkout. In high school, she visited Russia. Her parents always had exchange students. They had like six or seven exchange students over the course of their lives, and they had some Russian exchange students, and she went over to Russia, and this was very soon after the fall of the Soviet Union, and she was just so amazed by the poverty and devastation there, and at the same time, the hospitality of the Russian families that welcomed her. And she compared that to her experience living with the Palestinian families that she stayed with as well, that in the midst of all of that devastation, they could be so giving and generous and hospitable. And it shamed her because she was so had so much privilege herself. In college, she worked for 3 years in a mental health crisis center, where she worked with the very severely mentally ill. After 9/11, she became very, very active in the peace movement there. She was a leading activist. And so for me and for our family, it seems logical that she should have gone to Palestine. So this was her whole life, was always sort of being on the side of the underdog. Once she became aware of the terrible suffering of those under the occupation, once she understood that she could do something to help them, she felt she had no choice, she had to go. So she did. So that was her motivation, because that was her character. She was not an anti-Semite. She was not anti-American. She was not a supporter of violence. She was strongly committed to nonviolence. And she was not a naive, unwitting dupe of terrorists. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was standing for peace and justice.
Across the green line, back to the open shore. Did you think this was just another day in a dirty war? And when you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed, one more home destroyed?
You've been listening to Atlanta Indie Media's Currents of Resistance. That was Elizabeth Corey, cousin of slain ISM activist Rachel Corey. For more in-depth coverage of Ms. Corey's killing, you can find it at PAL Solidarity, PALSolidarity.org, or electronicintifada.net.
The music you've been hearing tonight is Song for Rachel, available for download at davidrobics.com. For more information about Atlanta Indie Media, visit atlanta.indiemedia.org. Your questions and comments are always welcome at currentsofresistance@wrek.org.
You ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself for pointing out that you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other side the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation, the very definition of a land without a nation. And if peace is what you're after, then let us not deceive. We'll come on the day the tanks return to Tel Aviv. On the one side there is hunger and bulldozed olive trees. On the other is the army ruling by decree.